The court then will go on to the last case of the day, which is DeVries versus L&L Custom Builders. And we have extra time on this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Each side has 15 minutes. Is it Mr. Eaton?
Mr. McKernan, Your Honor, on behalf of the appellant.
Okay, Mr. McKernan, excuse me. Yes, I was looking at the appellee's sign up sheet. Good morning to you. Before you proceed, Mr. Scaglione?
Yes, sir.
Are you going to do the entire argument? Okay, and you have to govern that between yourselves. You understand that. Very good. Any questions by either party at this point? Mr. McKernan, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, Mrs. DeVries. My name is Brian McKernan, and I'm here appearing today on behalf of the appellant, L&L Custom Builders, Inc. I'd like to reserve 6 minutes of my time for rebuttal and in response to the cross appeal. Due to the limited time, I'd like to address the following three reasons why this court should reverse the district court's judgment dated March 10th, 2021. First, appellant was entitled to a directed verdict, as no reasonable person could have concluded that appellees did not have notice that a problem existed within their home within the relevant statute of limitations period. Second, the district's court jury instruction on appellant's statute of limitation argument, instruction number 5, was improper and prejudicial. And third, even if this court were to assume that the judgment rendered on March 10th was proper, the district court failed to set aside that judgment by the amount the plaintiffs received from co-defendant who settled on the day of the trial. With respect to the error in not providing a directed verdict, the applicable statute of limitations is 25-223. That statute contains a 4-year period. It also does contain a discovery provision, which states that if the cause of action is not discovered within that 4-year period or within 1 year preceding the expiration of that 4-year period, then the cause may be commenced within 2 years from the date of discovery, whichever comes earlier. As this court made clear in Andres, the relevant inquiry here is, did the appellees have notice of a problem in their home within that 4-year statute of limitations period? If they did, their claim was time barred, and appellants were entitled to a judgment as a matter of law. Again, the nature of the problem, the source of the problem, that's not the relevant inquiry. The relevant inquiry is notice of the problem. Appellees knew they had a problem, and they knew it at least as of May 1st, 2015. And we know that because there was a structural engineer that came out and did an inspection of the home. Not only did the structural engineer do an inspection, but he drafted a report. He stamped it with his engineering stamp. And he said, you've got a bunch of problems here, and here's what I recommend you do to remedy those problems, including pictures. That Donen report is exhibit 384, 28 pictures, clearly identifies the existence of the problem. At trial, appellees admitted that they had that report and it identified a problem. More importantly, their own structural engineer that came to testify at trial also admitted the existence of the problem. And this language was absolute.
As you go through here, can you address the estoppel issue as well?
Thank you. And I think that hits on the problem with the directed verdict, because if you piece through the defense that appellees actually raised the statute of limitations. It's not that they didn't have knowledge or that there was a factual issue of the knowledge. It was that the appellant lulled or fooled them into thinking that either no problem existed or that they would take care of that problem. Well, the problem is that's an equitable estoppel claim. And as this court has determined, if you want to avail yourself as an equitable with the equitable estoppel doctrine, you have to plead it. Take a look at the amended complaint.
Can it also be implicitly raised?
I don't believe it can, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any case law that would suggest it can be implicitly raised. But more importantly, it wasn't implicitly raised in this case. And if the court looks at the procedural history, there's no reason why they should ever have to rely on an implicit raising of that. We filed a motion to dismiss. We filed a summary judgment. We filed a directed verdict, and we filed for a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. If there was an issue, they were aware of it well before this matter went to trial.
During the case in chief for the appellees, they discussed the DeVries's position on that, didn't they? That testimony came in objected to, correct?
So there was discussion about testimony that was done by the co-defendant at the time, TD2, an engineering firm in Omaha that did a geotechnical investigation after the problems had arisen. And there was testimony in terms of what they did, what their report said, and what appellee's response was to that report. The problem, Your Honor, is that's relevant testimony with respect to the particular timeline. We had filed a motion to keep that evidence out because it was something that had not been pled. And so there was testimony to answer your question that as they were going through these reports of TD2, you know, we were led to believe this wasn't a problem. But you know what there wasn't testimony about, and what there's not testimony about in their brief is any discussion about the Donen report and how the Donen report didn't lead them to knowledge of the problem.
Was there testimony? I'm going to paraphrase it here. From the DeVries, Mrs. DeVries specifically, that she was told this wasn't a serious problem and that the appellants were going to take care of it. And that continued on over a period of time until a point where they felt they had to file a suit.
That was testimony that was advanced by the appellees.
And what effect would that have?
So I don't think it has any effect because, again, Your Honor, I think that testimony is relevant in terms of a time frame, right? Who did what and when that took place. But it's not relevant because this court has said that if you want to avail yourself to that equitable estoppel defense, then you need to plead it. And they never did plead it after being put on notice of it and after having plenty of time to do it. And we are entitled to rely on what those pleadings say.
Was there an objection to the equitable estoppel component of the statute of limitations jury instruction?
So there was a motion in limine made. Absolutely there was. And that goes back to our second reason that even if the court would conclude that directed verdict wasn't proper, that instruction was improper. And we absolutely made an objection to that because what you have here is a long jury conference that took place, I think, an hour and a half before the closing arguments. And what the court finally did is, well, why don't you guys just include the language of the statute? And so there was a jury instruction that was drafted that included the language of the statute, but it also included this equitable estoppel defense. And interestingly, if the court looks at that jury instruction, and it's at transcript 619 and 620, it indicates, however, if you find that defendant fraudulently, inequitably, and/or lulled plaintiffs into action, then you must disregard defendant's defense to the statute of limitations. We did object to that particular.
Where's the objection?
In the after the informal jury conference, on the record to the jury conference, we objected to the language of that objection and for them including the equitable estoppel defense because it hadn't been pled.
As I read, I think that portion of the jury instruction conference, there's an objection. You say the defendant objects and believes a date should be utilized.
Right.
And then the court says, all right, very good. I'll overrule that objection. Otherwise, and then you say one point, just the record, Your Honor, we also believe that the discovery period was not alleged in the amended complaint. Then move on. Where am I missing equitable estoppel somewhere in there?
The discovery period, the equitable estoppel is the basis to extend the discovery period that they're relying on as a defense to the statute of limitation claim.
So the reference to the discovery period is an argument, is an objection to the inclusion of the equitable estoppel language.
Absolutely, because I think if you look at the case law, it says if you want to extend the statute of limitations period, you have to allege specific facts that would allow for that discovery period to be invoked.
You would agree the discovery tolling issue and the estoppel issue are separate issues for analysis, aren't they, though?
I guess I'm not understanding.
In the jury instruction, there was three paragraphs of that. That jury instruction, paragraph two was the discovery, paragraph three was the estoppel, correct?
Correct.
And your objection appeared to go to the discovery paragraph as opposed to the estoppel paragraph.
No, the objection went to the estoppel paragraph because the discovery period has to do with what the triggering event is, whether it's notice of a problem or something else. The equitable claim is the basis that allows you to extend the discovery period on that statute of limitations. And so that's what that objection was based upon. And if there's no other questions on that, I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Scaglione, good morning to you.
Good morning. And please, this court, Wheaton, Quinn, Eaton, and I are appearing from Coley Jessen on behalf of Bonnie DeVries and Tab DeVries. Bonnie isn't present in open court. If I could have a warning at 8 minutes, I would appreciate that. I'd like to make two quick points before I get to the statute of limitations issue, which I realize is dominantly before us. But I would like to make two quick points on damages, and I promise to quickly move to statute of limitations. The first point I'd like to make on damages is to call the court's attention to the fact that the contract that L&L signed was a design build contract. They were the designer and the builder. So when we think about making the plaintiffs whole, we have to consider they were responsible for construction and design. So they complain that the investigation and design phase should not have been included in the damage, but that was the scope of work that they undertook, was design and build. So when we put forth evidence that to figure out what the problem was, to design the fix and then to construct it, that all is part of making the plaintiff whole. This was not a runaway verdict. In fact, the jury denied our claim on the bluff and land damage, and they didn't grant us one penny more than what we placed in evidence in the exhibits, which was $418,000 approximately. So it was not an excessive verdict. It did not cover non-recoverable damages. The other quick point.
This was a general verdict, was it not?
It was.
And what impact does that have?
Well, then the benefit of not having to segregate these issues as well as the issue in the statute of limitation, they could have submitted special verdict forms to answer specific questions. Did you find this and did you find that? They didn't request that. As such, the benefit of the verdict is broader for us. We're deemed to have won on every issue. The second point I'd like to make on damage that they raise is that they should have received credit for our settlement with TD2. That settlement occurred on the eve of trial and they were dismissed the first day of trial. At the point TD2, the subcontractor of L&L, they were a subcontractor designer. There were three categories of damages in play. One was the construction cost to the house. Two was the construction cost to the land and the bluff. And three were the stigma damages. All three categories of damages were in play at that point.
when we settled with TD2, what LNL tries to confuse, I believe, in the court, in their briefs to this court, is they want to look at the end of the trial after stigma damages had been dismissed and after we had lost the verdict on the land and the bluff issues. There was one issue left at that point, and that was the damage to the house. And they're saying, well, we should get credit. Well, there's nothing in this record that would help the trial court or this court understand what did TD2 pay for? Which category of damage were they paying for? There were three categories of damages at risk to TD2 at the time. There's no way to segregate that. There should be no credit extended.
When does the record show us that the first demand for a copy of that settlement agreement was made by the appellants?
Not until after their motion to alter judgment was denied. So they knew before the trial and certainly by the first day of trial that the settlement had occurred, and they delayed any discovery on that till the end. They also did not seek to depose anyone or TD2 or seek more details. They just simply asked for the settlement agreement, and that did not help segregate the damages so that credits could be extended. The last point I would make is the damage on the bluff, which we felt truly was TD2. They're the ones who issued the report that this lot was buildable based on the bluff issues. Our claim against TD2 was primarily on the bluff. Our claim against LNL was the building and through privity, their responsibility for the bluff. I'd now like to speak to the statute of limitations. First off, the jury instruction conference, the sequencing, I believe, is very important. The jury instruction is number 5. We both came with proposed instructions. Judge Durr did not like either one. He told us to jointly go write another instruction. Mr. McKernan and I did that, and we came back with, quoting the statute, then equitable, or the discovery period, and then equitable estoppel. And we submitted that as a jointly drafted jury instruction back to the court. The court said, I think I like this, let's go with this. So the formal jury instruction was not based on any of our initial proposed jury instructions. It was based on that jointly drafted instruction. And that's where, as the justice correctly noted at page 921 and 22, the only two objections was number one, I believe the date should be included. That's telling the jury how to find a fact. So that was an improper objection. It was properly overruled. Number two, the discovery period was not alleged. The justice is also correct. Discovery and equitable estoppel are two completely different concepts. One is, when did you reasonably discover facts that might suggest you have a claim? The other is, you were told to do something that lulled you from filing the suit on time. Those are two completely different concepts. The objection was to not to including the discovery period because it wasn't alleged. There was no objection to equitable estoppel. And my suggestion is on general verdict, the general verdict that was issued, we don't know on which issue the verdict was actually decided on. So we get the benefit of we could have won on any of those. And it's up to them to come to this court and say, here's the specific finding that is inconsistent with the facts and law. They simply cannot do that. There is in the court rules 6-1115B, as well as the Hart case that we cite in our brief, that where it is treated that the issues are raised, the court will treat it as if it's pled and will not change the verdict. So here, Judge Durr multiple times ruled on this issue. Evidence came in at trial without objection on comprehension and belief and discovery and equitable estoppel. There were a few objections, but there was a lot of testimony that came in without objections. So the evidence was in the record. It was argued multiple times. It was briefed multiple times. This was clearly before the court. And so Judge Durr, who observed all of these rulings, observed all of the pleadings, he found that this was treated as raised and it should not affect the verdict. There's no abuse of discretion there. So with that, unless there's questions, we'll turn to the cross appeal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Eaton. Good morning to you.
And please the court, opposing counsel, Quinn Eaton on the cross appeal for the appellants. Throughout the suit, the DeVries have simply sought to be made whole for the damages caused by the appellant. That continues here on the cross appeal. The jury verdict's award gives to the DeVries money to effectuate the repairs for temporary repairable damages to their home. But even after that is done, there's still going to be permanent damages remaining to the value of the home. The district court and appellant have both tried to frame this issue as if the DeVries here seek some novel form of damages. That's simply not the case. Really, all this is about is a different application of the law that currently exists and has existed for a very long time, the expectation interest of the DeVries. You can go back to the very basics here, and we can stay there the whole time. You go to section 347 of the restatement of contracts adopted by this court. The court in the restatement says that an injured party in breach of contract has a right to damages based on their expectation interest, and that's measured by the loss in value to them of the other party's deficiency. And so here, the DeVries have been denied the opportunity to seek the entirety of that value.
Isn't it true that if the athletes were able to recover the full damages they sought, the repair of the house, the repair of the bluff, the lot damage, and the stigma damages, did that actually recover more than they initially paid for the house and the lots?
I think that would have to be recalculated essentially if you're gonna, we don't know what the bluff stigma was, that was never done. So I can't answer that for certain, but if they have to fix the house and there's still damages left over, I think the argument still remains. They're still gonna lose money eventually when they go to try to sell that house. So they're not really gaining because they're essentially recouping losses they're gonna take later on when they try to sell the house. Here, the purpose of the expectation interest is to put a party in the same position they would have been absent the breach. Here, absent appellant's breach, the DeVries would have had a home free of defects, and they would have presented expert testimony to demonstrate their home would be worth $213,000 more than it's going to be even once the repairs are done. So that loss in value is directly caused by the appellant's action. And thus, even once the cost of repairs are put into the home, the DeVries are not going to be in as good a position as they would have been absent appellant's breach.
Are there any other areas in the where party can get damages for what is basically damage to their reputation of property?
Well, I think it's pretty unique here because...
Well, I guess first is, would you agree with that characterization, that that's what you're seeking here, is that defendants have damaged the reputation of the DeVries property?
In a way, but the reputation goes directly to the value of the home. And that's one of the objections the appellants raise. They try to say that, you know, this is speculative, it's based on public perception of the home. True to some degree, but so is an appraisal of a home in general. An appraiser isn't counting bricks and boards and assigning dollar values and just adding them together. There's some objective elements, but there's some subjective elements about the community as well. In the end, it turns into a value, an actual number. That's a real number. When you go to sell and that number is lower, you've actually lost money, regardless of where that comes from, whether it's public perception. I don't think that's as big a deal as the appellant tries to make it out to be. The appellant in the district court relied on previous statements regarding cost of repair or diminution in value, treating those as the only potential options, and, you know, implied by saying that those are mutually exclusive. But we would argue that those two measures are simply proxies for measuring the expectation interests. The restatement even makes this express. As I noted, section 347 is the general rule. You're entitled to the loss and value caused to you by the other party. In contrast, cost of repair and diminution of value, that analysis only comes up in section 348. Which states that those two measures are recoverable if the loss in value to the injured party is not proved with sufficient certainty. So in essence, those two measures, they're convenient measures for trying to approximate what the loss in value, your expectation interest is, if you can't otherwise prove it. We provide these two really easy measures. But that shouldn't be a limitation and shouldn't be the only possibilities if you can actually prove up what your expectation interest is here. in many cases.
Has Nebraska ever recognized damages for diminished market value based on stigma? Whether it's contaminations or the house is haunted or murders or anything else or lack of repairs like we have here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but I think it just ties directly into the, you know, diminution in value. Well, it's not the same in this context. Diminution in value of a property is recognized as a valid measure of recovery. And that's essentially what's going on here. It's the remaining diminution in value, even after the cost of repairs.
Is there anything that prevented your clients from seeking diminution in value as the measure is here?
I'd say they probably could have, but then, you know, really that's a pretty inefficient route because you're going to be inherently including the cost of repairs into that and getting to the same point where we are here now. You need this amount of money to fix it. And then even after that, here's the total amount. It would have come out to the same amount as what we're seeking here by the jury verdict we already have and the stigma damages we're now attempting to receive. So I suppose you could have, but then the same objection probably would have been raised by the appellant and we probably would have ended up in the same place. Plus, I think it's, you know, there's unique in the case law stating, you know, it's a person's home, they're entitled to the cost of repair. They need their home fixed. Here, they need their home fixed. And they need to not be hit with almost $250,000 loss when they go to try to sell this home someday. And it's also important on that point to note that they're not seeking the cost of repairs plus the total diminution of value, like what you would have measured at the very beginning. It's only the amount that remains after the cost of repairs. So when you look at it that way, the two measures are really entirely separate categories of damages. Cost of repairs for temporary damages that can be fixed, especially when it's a person's residential home. If you can fix the damages, you should fix it.
Wouldn't the stigma damages you're seeking be based on a public perception that's irrational?
I don't think it's irrational. It's a legitimate fear.
Isn't the theory of the cost of repair, this is what it is going to cost to bring this fully back to its pre-breach condition? And you're seeking more than that because you're saying, well, even if it is brought back to its pre-breach condition, public perception is going to be that it wasn't.
I think that's similar to my prior answer is that regardless of where it arises from, it's real because that buyer is going to pay less. And so to the DeVries, they don't care why that comes about. All they care about is because of the appellant's action, I've been hurt this amount of money when I go to try to sell the home. I would also say a lot of those issues are really going more to, see, I'm out of time. May I briefly conclude?
You may.
A lot of those issues really go more to the sufficiency or the weight of the evidence. If the appellants want to try to attack the methodology of the appraiser, they can do that in remand. If they want to say that there's, you know, not a good enough link here, the damage amount's incorrect, they can do all of that in remand. It's an entirely separate issue from just can the DeVries seek the loss in value that's occurred to them. So for that reason, we request the court to reverse the district court's decision on this point and remand for a trial limited to the stigma damages. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 4 minutes and 12 seconds, Mr. McKernan.
Thank you. I want to briefly address the comment about how this jury instruction arose, because I do think it goes to the equitable estoppel argument, whether it was properly preserved. The counsel's right. The parties couldn't come to an agreement on what an appropriate jury instruction was with respect to this particular issue. And the court did say, you two figure it out. Respectively, that's not our job to figure it out. That's the court's job to figure out, especially when two parties can't agree. And so what was provided then was a jury instruction, and we objected to that jury instruction. I think the district court's order on our judgment, notwithstanding the verdict, highlights how there was no disagreement on this particular issue. He says, as for plaintiff's equitable estoppel defense, this was not formally pled by the plaintiffs, and therefore the jury was never instructed on equitable estoppel, and the court will no longer address the issue. The court's not saying you waived it, you didn't object to it, you agreed to some particular jury instruction. Rather, the court's saying they didn't plead it, I didn't instruct them on it. I'm not going to comment anymore on it. There was no confusion as to what our objection went to. There's discussion about our set-off claim and that we didn't properly request that settlement agreement. The timing of this is important. There was a settlement of our co-defendant on the day of trial. Following that particular settlement, there was a verbal motion in limine made by the appellees where they sought and received an order in limine from this court that prohibited us from discussing the fact that TD2 was a party, that they settled, and any particular liability that may belong to TD2. So why, in one sense, they're saying we didn't do our job and requested a settlement agreement somehow during trial, they prohibited us from getting into those exact questions that would have allowed us to establish the claim of set off more fully.
Did you establish a set off hearing after the verdict?
Absolutely, because I think if the court would simply look to the amended complaint that was filed by the appellees, they would see that the exact same injuries are asked from both parties. And secondly, I think if they look at the motion in limine, where they admitted that the only liability for TD2 is that as our subcontractor. And if you think about it, that makes sense, right? TD2 didn't have any contractual privity with the appellees until well after the problems arose and they started doing substantive testing. Not before they purchased the lot, not during construction. The only exposure TD2 had was as a subcontractor of LNL. That's the only duty, that's the only privity that existed. And because of that, we are talking about the same injury. And we're talking about an absolute right to set off even without that particular settlement agreement. And when the court first addressed the issue, it said, well, we don't have the settlement agreement, so we can't make that determination. So we followed that up with a motion to produce the settlement agreement and reconsider. The court denied that and said, I don't need the settlement agreement. And frankly, he's probably right. If you think about it, most settlement agreements are going to contain a general release in the amount that they paid for in settlement. We are entitled to set offs and we don't need the agreement to tell us. Because we are entitled to a directed verdict, because the court got jury instruction number 5 wrong, and because the court failed to provide set off when it absolutely should have as a matter of law, we ask that this court reverse the decision of the district court and either enter a judgment in favor of the appellees on the directed verdict or remand this back to a new trial so a proper jury instruction can be provided. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Council, that concludes arguments for the day. Court is adjourned and you are excused.